Welcome to this week's Casterbris Podcast with a K, available on Casterbris, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Christian Corley. I'm the editor and your host today. With me is James McLean. James, how are you?
I'm your host, James McLean, and this is my mate, Christian Corley. He has very big hands.
Yes, indeed, I do.
Not for you. No, you can't argue that. Your hands are perfectly normal for you. That's normal size as hands should be, since for 40 years your hands... Well, no, for 40 years your hands haven't been that size. I hope they've not been that size.
No.
That would have been a very interesting, interesting
not,
birth.
Not quite 40 either, thank you.
Well, you know, you're getting on. Won't be long.
It probably won't, no. No,
do you fear it?
Do I fear 40?
Yeah.
No, I don't really. I'm not a fussy 40-year-old approacher, if you know what I mean. To me, it's just the same as 39 or 38 or whatever. It's just going to be another number. People seem to want me to do like birthday parties and public appearances or something. I don't know what it is they want me to do, really, and I'm really not interested. I just want to just do what I normally do.
A 40-year-old approacher sounds almost predatorial.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. Mm. Not the best term.
Probably a good market there. I don't imagine there's many.
Many what?
Who go for the 40-year-old approaching. I don't even know what that would consist of. I suppose it would be chatting up 40-year-olds with intents to do other things.
Intents? What, at a music festival?
Intense, it could be. There are a couple of musical festivals on at this moment, I believe.
Is there? What's on at the moment?
I think Reading just on, or
Reading?
Has been
right.
on, or
okay.
Phoenix. I lose track these days.
There's so many of them.
Same. Yeah.
There are so many of them. Hey, yeah. Now listen, dear listener, you may have noticed that the more astute and observant of you may have noticed that we didn't do a podcast last week.
We did.
But we did, actually, yeah. Now, kind of what happened is... the recording is basically Brian saying hello, and then there's 70 minutes of silence. Now, the more charitable
quality
among you might think, surely that's the best podcast ever. But we decided that we weren't going to put it out in quite that state. So we're recording on Sunday evening, a little bit earlier than usual this week. Apologies if you were expecting a podcast last week. We were expecting to be able to... publish one, so it's basically is a technical fault. The blame for which will lie squarely on my Brian's shoulders because he's not here. And so because it's an evening, I've got a little bit of a beverage. So cheers.
Is that a classy beverage?
It's a Krabby's ginger beer.
Well. I suppose classy in your neck of the woods, I don't know.
what would you consider to be a classy beverage for a Sunday evening?
Well, I was thinking...
Baby sham? Like,
well, baby sham's a little too 80s, I think. We've got beyond there. You know, we talk about the 40-year-old thing.
Pims?
I was thinking, you know, a dry sherry, maybe.
Right,
would be quite
okay.
Nice.
Right, I see. Dry sherry. What, some sort of evening soiree with your friends... Xander and Felicia.
Oh yeah, you could go with a whiskey or something if you're feeling a little manly, but that could be part and parcel of you approaching 40-year-olds.
Indeed.
Feeling a little
yes.
manly.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what are we talking about this week? What boring Doctor Who topic have we got this week to talk about?
Well, you say that. But as you don't know, you can't declare that it is boring as yet. Have you seen this autographed annual up for sale on eBay?
Well, if that is your case for defence. Yeah, I did see it mentioned on Casterbris, actually. I thought, we're on to the bit of fluff, are we? The fluff articles. How much is it going for?
I'm just loading it up because I put it up this morning. And obviously, I haven't seen... When I say put it up, I mean I published the article. It's not my auction. just want to underline that perfectly. If that was my item, I probably would not be selling it. I would, if I were to sell it, I would not do it through eBay, I don't think. I'd probably go to a private auction house. Do you know, when I was in London a few weeks ago, I took photos of the famous auction company, whose name escapes me at the moment. Mm. What are they called? How are the auctions? Sotheby's. For you know, future reference, just in case something gets auctioned on from the Doctor Who universe, so I don't have to pay anyone for the photos. Hey, look, now it is autographed by William Hartnell, and it is the first Doctor Who annual. William Hartnell signatures are quite rare, and even rarer in things like this in the annuals. So the asking price is quite high on this auction, but I don't think it's too high. Well. Yeah, maybe it's a bit too high. The starting price is a pound short of 1,000. I would probably have started that a bit lower, to be honest with you. But as I say, it is extremely rare. But again, as I say, I don't think eBay is the best outlet for that sort of item.
Does it have some sort of authenticity with it?
It doesn't have any with it, no. But... No, I agree with you. I mean, that is...
Hashtag scoffed then, I think.
Did you? Indeed. You do. Yeah. I mean, that kind of thing is needed these days, I think. I mean...
I think so.
A comparison, it does appear to be... On first glance, it does appear... If it's not genuine, it's an awfully good forgery.
But I mean, like, there was... first of all, I don't know either way, so I'm not suggesting it is a forgery. I'm just saying if you're going to ask a large amount of money...
Yeah.
You've got to make sure that you can really justify it, I think, especially if it ever came back to bite you in the...
No, I think you're right.
But I mean, it's like that example of a totally different example, the Liberator from Blake 7 that went for a vast amount. And in the end, it looked like, again, I don't know because I've not seen it, that it was actually by Bowers who did the original, but it might have been one that a copy he had done as a private.
As opposed to a private one.
Yeah, and not one that was on screen, as the eBay almost intimated. So, I mean, that's I think what you mean. When you go through eBay, it becomes a little more muddy.
Yes,
still
it does.
A great thing to have.
But also, the other thing with eBay is that, you know, if you're going through a private, so like Sotheby's, maybe not, because you might have quite high commission, but there's also a company called Vectis, which has an auction house near here, actually, which I attended once. And the quality of the material that they have in there is really good. There was a load of Action Man stuff, and there's some of, if I remember rightly, it was a couple of years ago, there was some Japanese stuff as well, which you might have been interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, they do it on bulk, and then they have, you know, they have lots, and then they have auctions for the larger items and things like that. But, you know, they require things like authenticity and all that sort of thing. But you're guaranteed... To an extent, you're guaranteed a larger price because although eBay is on the web and it's a hugely popular website, you're going to get the populist vote, the populist audience. But for something like an auction where people can, you know, vote online and vote by telephone, you're getting the experts, the expertise, the proper enthusiasts, the real audience, the real customer for your item. So for something like that, I don't think... that eBay is the right place for it. Haven't had a day or so to think about it, but it's a fascinating auction either way.
Does it belong in a museum?
There's an argument to say it possibly belongs in the Doctor Who experience, I would have thought.
Yeah, there's an argument for that, but then again, it's a private thing. I'm not saying it has to be donated.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And,
it starts to become, you know, 50 years of history. It's starting to become really history.
Yeah. I agree.
And television is such a driving force these days. I was watching, and this could be a recommendation for later that I'd rather not do, but you're going to make us. I was watching The Thick of It and thinking, you know, you look at television as a cultural, not like, let's not use the word pop culture because I think that's derivative, as a cultural medium. And you look at Peter Capaldi, who does, you know, amazing stuff on The Thick of It, and you think, yeah, and his roots come from his love of Doctor Who, which ultimately stems back to William Hartnell, you know, the sort of matrixes historically, you know, how our culture is shaped these days. Things like William Hartnell becomes really important. actually becomes a really important historical figure, because it doesn't just tap into Doctor Who. It taps into all other different manners of things within acting, within production, within art. It's everything's so interconnected. It belongs in a museum.
Who would dare argue with that? Speaking of television driving things, have you seen
Stella? Probably. Sorry.
Yeah. Speaking of television driving things, as you started your little monologue there.
Rant. Monologue.
Yeah. Stephen Moffat's been asked if the changing face of television would eventually alter the way Doctor Who was brought to audiences. To which he claims, I still feel Who is more of a once-a-week thing. What do you think? Because this is something that we discussed a few weeks ago, isn't it, about the change in nature of television and the on-demand thing.
Well, he was talking about it more going whether it would go on to an on-demand.
Yeah,
rather
like Netflix
than what
we were
talking
yeah.
about, which is how the production would be handled within the industry.
Hmm.
You know, would it be farmed out as an independent-run thing for the BBC or, you know, things like that? I think it's too flagship to go down that route, and I still don't think that these, while it's hard to quantify these things like Netflix and Amazon in terms of viewing figures, because they don't have to release any because they've got no sponsors to have to ego stroke, so they don't release data because they don't have to. So it's hard to really say what.
Because I happen because to know that. Nielsen are going to start releasing data from Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu.
That's interesting. How are they managing to do that, and what justification?
Hang on,
because Nielsen's justification is for advertising. That's why Nielsen's stone
yeah.
course.
Okay, so
advertising is what funds the stations.
This was reported on The Verge 3 days ago. Nielsen is. I just took that from Google, and here's the rest of it. Nielsen is now tracking ratings for nearly 1,000 streaming shows. Studios are now getting data on who's watching what on Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu. This was initially reported in the Wall Street Journal. Nielsen is currently months into a program that allows it to track shows on Netflix and other services, Amazon Prime and Hulu, and has data on 1,000 shows. They started measuring viewership data on streaming sites last winter as a means of giving major studios like Fox and NBC Universal a clearer sense of how streaming affects their revenue.
Yeah.
So that's they've basically been commissioned to do it.
So they found a way around it. Because I remember being told that there was a big thing about the scheduled broadcasters sort of having a bit of a funny thing about things like Netflix and the like, because they couldn't undermine it in the sense of trying to what their viewerships were and how many people were signing up, because they weren't having to be told.
Yeah.
Because, say, there was no need for Nielsen, there was no advertisers, there was no need to release that data. So this looks like it's a way where the industry can actually find out how it is affecting. Interesting.
Mm. What is also interesting is it still doesn't track streaming content on mobile devices. So it's only doing it on home computers.
Well, it's a waste then, isn't it?
TVs. But, you know, you've got a big, you must have at least 50% of tablets and smartphones being used for Netflix.
I mean, I was watching The Thick of It. I was watching it in my bed today on Sunday on my tablet.
Mm.
I never watched it on the television or on a computer. So, yeah, I think it's a dangerous way of correlating data for a service which isn't meant technically, wasn't actually generated to be really sat on in front of a TV screen. Okay, maybe a computer, maybe, but the way the market works now sounds like a very backward way of gathering data. But then I think a lot of people in the industry would say that Nielsen is in a lot of ways a backward or a catch-up service.
Mm.
Because it doesn't, and it still never really has taken into account the way that revenue comes in from all the other sources beyond revenue from advertisement, is what a lot of people in the industry have said. Whether that's true or not, I'm not in the industry to say, but, you know, I remember Ron Moore always saying that was very frustrating with Galactica, that Nielsen would be there, you know, and there'd be scrutiny over the viewing figures, but how much they would actually sell as DVDs, how much was, you know, down, how much would be watched as, you know, on various, I don't think they had the streaming sites then, but it didn't catalogue everything.
Mm.
ways of that product was going to make money. So I think it can be it's obviously a dangerous thing, but I think going back to your original question, I think as long as scheduling stays in, and I think scheduling will stay in for a while yet, even though the services are becoming more and more easy to access, good value, I guess, and having original content. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that might change, but I can't see Dog 2 being a flagship. They want that high at the front. I don't see it moving at all.
But then again, I mean, they have released stuff overseas beforehand, and this would be a kind of a similar tactic, wouldn't it? So maybe with the right deal.
It would have to be a very good... Well, you see, this is, again, the deal has to... I mean, you're still talking about first run.
Yeah.
And the first run at the moment will always, unless the BBC did it on iPlayer, which would be a bit weird, they're not going to give their major flagship a first run on another platform, are they? That's just not...
Probably not a full series, no.
No. I mean, I could imagine them... I imagine they could do a deal to have a mini episode or something like that on a streaming service if it was... But then you've still got the problem with the commercial arm. And this is, as far as I understand, something which has been bandied a lot to and forth at the moment, is where the BBC sits with how much in-house content to how much it farms out to independents, and how that sort of charter works with all the other independent companies like Channel 4. Well, Channel 4's not independent, but uses independents, should I say. So... You know, while you've got these certain charters with the BBC about what they can make commercial revenue from and all this, I think it becomes horrendously complicated. If that changes, maybe, as you say, the market changes into a way that we can't predict. But as it stands, BBC's always going to keep its first run to itself, isn't it? It's not going to be mad, especially something like Doctor Who. So, yeah, no, I don't think there's any fear, if that's what the topic's about.
Okay. Transition time. This past week, we have, or some of us, have... did you like that, did you?
It seemed a little forced, but we'll go with it.
Okay, thank you. The opening episode, The Magician's Apprentice, from Series 9, was screened in Edinburgh this week. And some spoiler-free comments have been released on Twitter from people who were fortunate enough to see it. I'm just going to go through some of this, because there is an interesting kind of... atmosphere around them. Patrick Spruill, who is at Grumblenook on Twitter, offers these spoiler-free musings. Hands-on, seriously ballsy storytelling, felt so much like a finale-like stakes. The pace is brisk, zips around a lot at the start, but slows to some incredible drama. It felt like new Doctor Who, had a fresh flavour. Capaldi, Gomez and Coleman give us a different Doctor, Missy and Clara. It's very different to Series 8, felt like serious drama. And you've also got Ben Morris. Enjoyed the premiere of Doctor Who tonight. A nice foreboding shocks. What do you think of those comments? Because that does offer a kind of a different feel for Series 9 to what we've had so far.
It's always the problem, isn't it, with audience feedback, is that who is the audience? You know, where do they come from? I mean, if it's, you know, I'm not suggesting here, you know, is it vetted in any way? Is it selected? Who selects the comments? I'm not saying that it's, I know I'm becoming awfully cynical, but you can't help it, can you? Especially if you've just watched three seasons of The Thick of It. But I don't know. What do you think of it?
Well, I think there's a good chance for Doctor Who to be quite edgy in Series 9, actually.
Well, what do you think of it?
I had a feeling previously from some interviews that have come along and some stuff that I've read. And this, you know, this is before the screening. And now we've had these comments after the screening. I mean, I'm optimistic. I don't want to get my hopes up too much, but I am optimistic that we're going to get something that's a little bit different.
Well, so am I, but I was optimistic about Series 8, and
Series 8 has got some good aspects to it.
Yeah, but there was some good stuff in Series 7.
I think, Series 7's got a massive reputation problem.
It does.
The amount of criticism I've seen for Series 7. I mean, this is the series that gave us Hyde. Hyde, which is a fantastic episode. I really like Hyde.
I think it's funny. I was watching some of them again on a streaming service. And first time I've rewatched them in a long time. And it's funny, isn't it, how age does mellow you, doesn't it, Brigadier? I've got it. I really wish I hadn't said that, but it's true. I mean, I was watching Not the Death of Amy Pond. I can't remember what the episode's called off the top of my head.
Which one's this?
Daleks in Manhattan, but with statues.
The Angels Take Manhattan?
That's the one, yeah. And I was thinking, I'm actually quite enjoying some of this. Yes, River Song's still great, but because she's now in the past, it mellows. The grating isn't so painful, so you deal with it. And you think, oh, this is okay. Yeah, there's still some stupid stuff in here, but I'm quite enjoying this. You know, it's not that bad. So, yeah, I was watching a few of them, and I was thinking, yeah, I mean, just talking to one of our colleagues on Facebook, Rings of Akaten, I still like. I know he loathes it. Mm-hmm. Bad luck, James. But I quite like it. I watched it again. I thought, yeah, it's quite a sweet number for this. And yeah, Hyde's good. And if you include them in Series 7, it was up to you. Day of the Doctor. Time of the Doctor, I still enjoy. I mean, there are some stuff ones.
Yeah, there's the Cybermen one, isn't there? Which never been able to get along with here.
The cowboy one doesn't work in the first half.
Well, I rewatched the podcast one. I rewatched the cowboy one a few weeks ago, and when I initially watched it, I did feel it was trying too hard to try and do something a bit different with something that we've seen before. But watching it without that sort of feeling, it was more. I just switched my brain off and watched it, to be honest with you.
Well, that's it. When you rewatch stuff, you know, you tend to. It's not like you re-edit. You sort of, you're in a different position, aren't you? You're looking at it without expectation, without hope. So that was sounding particularly depressing. You've got no hope there. You know what's going to happen, so you accept it for what it is. And when I watched that one, Town Called Mercy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I was really disappointed that the Browder character, which was really interesting, was killed off just to give the Doctor the sheriff role, which was boring and done before.
Yeah.
Perhaps if I watched it again, that would irritate me less. And so I could just try and enjoy the little bits that are okay. And I think that was the same with Angels in Manhattan. You know, it's quite, you know, that last bit, even though it's, River is still awkward calling them mother and father, but when Amy goes to join Rory in the past is still a great little Matt Smith moment, you know. And there's that lovely little moment where in the beginning in New York, when they're there with the glasses and Amy's lines on her face, there's some nice dialogue. So yeah, I think going back, Series 8 wasn't bad, but it didn't feel like anything new to me. So I suppose, and they were sort of promoting it as being so different, and he'd be so different, and, you know, be lots of shocks, and there was no shocks. It was some good stories in there, as we've said last week. But, so yeah, I guess I'm just really...
Just to reiterate for the listener, the stories that we talked about last week...
Yes. Mummy on the Orient Express.
Mummy on the Orient Express and Flatline, and a bit of Listen.
Yeah, but didn't blow me away the series. So yeah, I'm just a bit jaded. I think I can't believe it's going to be anything mind blowing. I've not seen anything really work as a series from 2010. Anything I've thought, yeah, that series has really been a game changer. I've seen times where I felt them trying to change it. I think Series 6 they tried to throw a few curveballs in and it just didn't quite work, but they tried.
Well, again, that was something that we talked about last week, that mid-season cliffhanger, which was kind of on the wrong episode.
Yes.
Like game-changing cliffhanger. The game-changing cliffhanger should have been Amy Pond, in our opinion,
yeah.
Or my opinion, certainly. Pond being blown up with a sonic screwdriver for us to discover that Amy hasn't been with the Doctor for some time. And instead we get a story that isn't a cliffhanger. It kind of... ties things up and we discover that River Song is who she
well, who she I think is. That was the other problem, is his obsession with River Song just took over from the, you know, the storyline, which was really looked like it was meant to be about the Doctor and a baby, Amy having a baby. They seem to sort of be the sort of kind of focus of this series, the Death of the Doctor.
Yeah.
And it just kept feeling like it just wanted to talk about River Song. So it just felt a mess. You know, rewatching some of season five, I was thinking, actually, while there's a lot in this series I don't like, there's a lot of, again, storylines which just don't get sorted out, that just drift.
Mm.
There's Amy is very inconsistent and far less palatable in that series than she is later on. And Matt Smith isn't as good as he is later on, I don't think. But there is some good stuff in there. It did feel like it did have a certain more coherency to it.
Mm.
But yeah, now I've not felt any attempts which have worked. I think that's what we're trying to say. So I'm cynical that this next series is going to do something that works.
Well, certainly in terms of, and again, something, listener, that you won't have heard us speak about last week, this the story formatting and the two-parters.
Yeah.
It seems there's a three-parter and possibly a single one in the mix in there.
Oh, yeah, of course they never heard any of this, did they?
No, they didn't, no.
Just to me, it's done, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
And
now so, I understand why you kept explaining.
Yes, no, that's okay. It does seem that they are trying to do something different, and certainly the shape of the series is itself going to be different. That is something that we know is going to be different, that we haven't seen really since 2005. So,
but a change in tone is something which would be quite exciting. You know, if there
absolutely.
Is a sort of serious drama, that would be what we were sort of saying last year for the hope for Series 8, would be a feeling of tone and feel that it was a different show. That would give us something to be excited about, and it didn't really happen.
But then again, was Tom Baker's first series, was that really that different to John Pertwee's last series?
I think it's pretty different. I don't think it's just the lead actor.
Yeah, I think it starts off similar, doesn't it? And then it goes off in its own direction.
I mean, Robot feels like a leftover.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
There's no doubt. And that's not just UNIT, but just the whole structure feels a leftover.
But then it goes off in its own direction, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I didn't feel that with any of Series 8. I mean, Listen felt the best, but Listen felt like echoes of stuff that Moffat's done before, which is his good stuff as well. So not saying it was bad, but it didn't feel like it was really... The only thing that made it feel a little edgier was that you really got a feeling of what Capaldi could do with that part, which he doesn't feel like he's always allowed to do. But yeah, no, there's nothing that really... It seemed to me, in a funny way, Series 8 seemed to be making mistakes I'd have expected in Series 6. You know, you've only got that limited 45 minutes, and yet you start trying to do this really overly distracting companion story arc alongside a brand new Doctor, which you think, surely that's mad. Surely you allow the companion, the Doctor, to stabilise themselves, and with the actors to stabilise, and the writers to stabilise, and the audiences to stabilise. But, you know, you throw in a new Doctor, then you just totally take away everything that would, you know, bring coherency. That feels like a Series 6 mistake. And it was done in Series 8. So it felt like it was making mistakes, which I didn't see how it could be making those mistakes at this sort of age in the show.
Yeah,
So if they get it right, this series, as you would say, bonza.
I certainly would. Listen, how do you feel about, on a similar sort of angle, and without getting too deep into this, because it's possibly something we can talk about in future on a kind of a trifecta podcast, about Doctor Who being reimagined, classic episodes being redone in a different way or take them in a completely different direction.
As in what sort of format?
In a not in a same universe or same continuity format. A kind of a Doctor Who Unbound-esque sort of format, like taking a new Doctor, maybe a Peter Cushing replacement or whatever, and then taking classic stories and reimagining how they go.
I think that'd be fairly interesting, wouldn't it? I think it'd be a pointless long-term project. I think in the end, there's always a danger, as Star Trek is discovering with its movies, that you start parroting reinterpretations of old stuff. You end up just immediately being compared old stuff rather than stuff, what you're doing. But if that is your intent of your series, is to do, as you say, sort of unbound reinterpretations of previous episodes, I think you get a little more flexibility because you're sort of saying, hey, like, yeah, we are just readapting and seeing what happens.
There's a thread on the Big Finish forum at the moment which introduces this idea. And basically says, where do we do it? It could be a semi-reboot involving some or all recasting and maybe take stories in drastically different directions. And, you know,
well, the way I would
how would you do it?
Well, the most obvious way to do it would be to do the same stories with different doctors and see how they play. Rewrite the stories for different doctors with different casts. So I suppose what you got with Human Nature.
In a way,
which was effectively. And I think that would be the most obvious, interesting way to do it. I mean, you could sort of... It might be interesting to see how Tom Baker would do a different version of Ark in Space now on Big Finish. That has a sort of minor interest factor to it. But, I mean, you couldn't say. It would be interesting to see how you would do, say, The Unearthly Child with... Peter Davison, or you know, just see how that would play out.
No, I mean, maybe Big Finish are heading down that route already by mixing up. They've already done this Locum Doctors series, haven't they? With the wrong doctors and companions mixed up, and now they're doing this thing with the modern, villains and monsters. But you know, when I read this, it reminded me of the Leakley Bible. Now, this isn't a medieval thing that you're not aware of. This is from the various attempts to make a movie in a US TV series. In Gary Russell's Doctor Who Regeneration, the story behind the revival of a television legend, Gary was given access to the Leakley Bible, and this various stories, classic stories, are rewritten. Reformatted with new synopses. For instance, this is The Talons of Wang Chang. The TARDIS in present-day New York, where a series of murders have been committed by the Chinese Tongue of the Black Scorpion, led by Wang Chang. He is, in reality, Magnus Greel, a war criminal from the future, whose experiments backfire and whose body needs the energy of others to survive. Hooking up with an NYPD cop, the Doctor and his companion, trace the location of Greel's lair and bring the murderer to justice.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a bit of a transposition, though, isn't it? I think that's the most boring way to do these sort of things, is when you are literally, almost literally, transposing from one period, one temporality to another.
Yeah, the Earthshock one is similar, more or less. Only the Cybermen have been remodeled as Cybes, which are kind of cybernetic pirates. I've always liked the design of those. But there's a lot of them that you know, the Celestial Toy Maker, Don't Shoot, I'm the Doctor, which I think you know what that's going to be. There's Tomb of the Cybes, there's the Yeti, and Ark in Space. Which, again, you're absolutely right. These they are just transpositions. There's nothing really.
Which is a shame, because the actual idea could be quite. I mean, if you say take an Earthly Child with Peter Davison, you would do something where you perhaps take the basic concepts, for instance a new set of companions wandering in on the Doctor. Doesn't mean you have to go back that they're suddenly taken to Roman times rather than the you could actually, to be honest, you could take them to a different time but have a totally different adventure, but would still carry the basic structure, or which would essentially be the drama of two people who are not of the Doctor's world being forced into the Doctor's world with a Doctor who wouldn't be comfortable or used to having humans on board his TARDIS and having to share a first adventure in a different situation. That, to me, would be how you do an Earthly Child. You wouldn't transpose it literally, but you just take what are the basic core functions in there and remodel that. Because the thing with Talons of Wing Chiang is that what do people really get from Wing Chiang? And I would say it's not the Magnus Greel. The thing that makes Wing Chiang resonate for audiences is the Victorian trope.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you've got to be careful what you're readapting, what you're pulling, what is your intertext there? Having just done 15,000 words of this in a dissertation, it's something that is obviously I'm quite interested in. I say obviously as if everyone should know, and they shouldn't, because I don't talk. But yeah, my point being is I think adaptation is a very fascinating subject on this sort of grounds, because sometimes what you think is the natural thing that you adapt and you transpose isn't the thing which is going to really be the dominant voice, isn't the dominant voice within that original that you're taking. So yeah, I know it's an interesting idea. I like the idea. I think if you were very creative, you could do some really interesting stuff, and you could really, because there's that wonderful thing up. Again, this is just straight transposition, but there was that wonderful thing with the Rings of Akatan, going back to that, where they've had, what, Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy have both done the Matt Smith speech.
Yeah.
And while that's, I know it's just a boring transposition, it just opens up the thought of, you know, how do other doctors, how would they react in similar-ish sort of situations? How would they open, you know, what would it be like if Sylvester McCoy was in the Planet of the Spiders to robot regeneration, you know, stuck on Earth, or sort of Spearhead from Space, maybe is probably a better example, you know, stranded somewhere with people he knows. I mean, someone could say countermeasures, which would probably be very boring. I'm sure you could find a better example. Whales, Delta and the Bannermen. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Spice it up. I think you've got a really good package of stories there.
I'm just looking through this Leakley Bible summary in the book, which you can still pick up on eBay and on Amazon. It's certainly worth having a look at how a Doctor Who series that never ultimately happens may have turned out. There's a concept of Davros. He's essentially Gandhi in a wicker chair with wheels.
Right.
He doesn't have the Dalek bottom half, because of course they were redesigning the Daleks for this as the spider Daleks, which look like Daleks
again,
initially,
yeah,
and then turn out to be kind of mutants with an opening up kind of Dalek shell. Sorry, James, do carry on.
I was just going to say, does Davros have to be crippled? Is that essential to him? I mean, I suppose there's a certain amount of the fragility in him. Could be argued that there is that sort of weird juxtaposition of this very powerful mental and manipulative creature being a fragile creature in a wheelchair, a disabled character. But is, you know, does he have to be wheelchair bound? Is that really what Davros is about? I don't think it is. It's what you first come up, it's what you first think of.
Well, I mean, why is he in a wheelchair? Still, with all his genius, why is he in a wheelchair? Why is he blind?
Because Davis was going to cover that, wasn't he, in Journey's End or Stolen Planet. There was a large chunk that they took throughout where they were going to flash back to Davros' origins, which would have been quite interesting. Or would that have been pedestrian? Is he a bit like the Joker? Is he quite nice not to have a proper origin? Is it quite nice not to see where I know Big Finish, I think, has covered this as well to a degree.
Davros.
But, you know, is there something more fascinating in keeping certain characters away from being hammered down? Or would hammering him down help? Has he become, I think it was an article that Alan Stevens wrote a few months ago, which was quite interesting, you know, is the Davros now really utterly divorced from the Davros from Genesis of the Daleks? So they're almost like totally opposite characters. Do you need to hammer him down perhaps now to sort of get back to what made him so special rather than Machiavellian? Yeah, I mean, it's just a funny thing, because I mean, this is exactly what Marvel and DC do in the comic books, don't they? All the time, either as one-off specials or just simply within their own continuity. They just reshift and re-alter the continuity again and retell these origin stories or retell classic stories, and they play around with their fiction a lot more than television really dares do. Maybe comics aren't seen as such a stringent canonicity because it's not got people in them. Maybe people don't like the thought of that with television shows.
I think with television it's different, isn't it? Because you've also got, you know, you'd then have to recast if you're redoing some things, like a character's origins, or if you're like retelling the story or whatever, you would have to recast. So you've got that aspect of it. I mean, it's an interesting topic. It's well beyond the boundaries of a standard podcast, the scope of a standard podcast, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Or maybe when they do something like this, or the next time they do an adaption of something, we should do an adaption special. An adaptation special. There must be, you know, I'm sure there'll be something that'll be adapted, be it Big Finish or book-wise. There's so much that could be talked on this topic.
Absolutely, yeah. I noticed as well, just before we move on to the recommendations, that Wartime is being re-released.
Cool.
Have you seen Wartime?
I haven't, actually.
I've been in a room while it's been on. but unfortunately, it utterly failed to grab me, unfortunately. So I'm a little bit kind of... I want it to do all right, but it just didn't grab me. And, you know, it may have been entirely down to my mood at the time. Sometimes you're interested in watching things, other times you're not. And I wouldn't like to say that it is in any way bad, although it doesn't have the best reputation of spin-off films. But it is kind of generally considered to be like the first fan-produced Doctor Who spin-off. So... It has that, at least, in its favour, and of course the presence of John Levine as Benton, and the voice of Nick Courtney. So, you know,
it might not be for everyone, but if nothing else, there is a sort of historical value to it. And I mean, Shakedown is one that doesn't quite work really on many levels, but it's nice to see these sort of. It's nice to see these sort of experimentations and attempts, and if nothing else, there's a historical pattern, isn't there?
Yeah.
These things all build. They're all part, again, of the same matrices that we were talking about earlier with Capaldi, and then they will eventually become parts and influences on what we have now. Even if you go down to Lethbridge Stewart's granddaughter, is it? Is Kate...
Daughter.
I get mixed up with her. Which one was she from? She was it wasn't Wartime with her. Was it Down?
I think it was Downtime. Yeah.
Downtime. Yeah. And it takes me back as well, because I remember the the Probe series. I remember getting a couple of those on VHS because they were cheap. With Peter Davison being involved, and obviously Caroline Johns. And it's sort of kind of fascinating to see these interim years of what's been developed and created in this space left by this lack of TV show.
Yeah. A couple more notes on Wartime. It also has Michael Wisher in one of his last roles, and Nick Briggs is in it as well, in probably one of his first roles.
Well, that's it. I mean, Nick Briggs is a massive catalyst, isn't he? You trace him back and forward. Which is it's incredible. I mean, especially I finished reviewing We Are the Daleks last week, and listening to the behind the scenes on that, and he's talking very confidently, and he's there sort of major power in Big Finish, writer. You can't knock him for his Dalek voices at all, can you? They're incredible.
Especially, I love it when he drops in a zippy as well.
Yes, I was going to say, you get the Roy Skelton one in there as well. And that only comes from someone who is absolutely obsessed with the show, that they want that minutiae of interest. And again, that makes this tension, isn't there, between where fans damage a show and where fans enhance a show. And you can certainly say some fans who manage to get onto the show can sometimes cause damage. Some can cause wonders, depending, because fandom is a very odd beast, isn't it? So it's really fascinating stuff. I'm glad that they're out there. I'd like to see more stuff from the 90s get republished.
1988 Wartime.
Wait, 1988?
Yeah.
I think it's also a good reminder, because I say it was the interim years, and it wasn't. And if Doctor Who had carried on, this stuff would have still been there in the interim years, because it was where people were able to get hold of video and able to start doing their own stuff at a reasonable budget.
It's been released among other things as well. There's a load of old Mythmakers being re-released.
Cool.
Richard Franklin, Bob Baker and Dave Martin, Liz Sladen, Bob May, the Doctor Who magazine team. That'll be interesting. I'm not sure Which team that is?
It's great, because I mean, I remember at the time there was a TV sci-fi catalog, because the only way you'd get things for things like Doctor Who, unless you were nearby a specialist shop, would be mail order. Mm. And there was one called John Fitton, who did a lot of mail orders at the time, sort of back end of the 80s. And, you know, things like the Mythmaker releases were really big things. You know, they were big videos which were really pushed on mail order, and they were very popular. It was a slice of the period that people now wouldn't understand, in the same way I probably wouldn't understand the various cornflake stuff that you'd get in the 1970s with John Pertwee stickers and you know, and cigarette cards or whatever. It's fascinating to see these eras. I was just going a little off topic. I was on one of the I was looking through an archive of old Starbursts,
right.
The beauty of the internet. And I just love it when you find stuff of the time. The place where I study, there's a room which is just filled with just archives, just magazines going back to the 60s, even earlier, on movie and television magazines. And to actually go and actually look through and see not just the excitement of seeing the adverts of the time, which is kind of cool, but seeing how stuff is promoted. I was reading one from 78, and it was talking about Alien, and it was saying how there's this new film coming out from Ridley Scott called Alien. We know nothing about it. They won't tell us who the alien is. We have they've released these photos of the cast and this one group photo, and we're told only one person will survive. Who's it going to be? And they just got a picture of the cast photo. You know, they hadn't got a clue what Alien was going to be about, not a clue what was going on, and no clue who was going to actually live. That was the pitch of it. Who would survive? And you don't get that from the retrospective. You don't see it until you actually see the stuff at the time. There was even one article which was talking about Star Wars in 78 and predicted that Darth Vader would be his father. It was thrown away as a casual comment. This sort of thing could happen when we probably find out that Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father. And yet, you know, people would have been thinking along those lines. But retrospectively, you see the Empire Strikes Back as being the time people realize he'd be the father. So, you know, this stuff like the Mythmakers, all this stuff is so historically interesting because they really show you what's going on at the time, which you don't really see if you're just looking back historically. You've got to sort of get this stuff to really feel.
Funnily enough, I've got a bag of old copies of Starburst in my cupboard to my right.
I've got a TV Zone and a few other stuff. First issue of TV Zone sitting not far from me somewhere.
Have you?
With Sylvester McCoy on the front.
Have you?
Yeah, bless him. And the brand new Enterprise from Star Trek Next Generation back in 87 or 88, whenever it came out.
Yeah.
I remember buying that at my local petrol station. I mean, this is the beauty of the 40 that we were talking about at the beginning, which if we can just sort of do a nice comeback to, a callback, is that, you know, age isn't brilliant, but you look back and there's all these fascinating moments that you can re-explore. So if you're young, enjoy getting older, because there are some benefits to it.
If you're young, why the hell are you listening to us?
I don't know.
It is.
And there's pills for the other stuff, so.
The pills
Sorry.
For the other stuff. Okay.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Not really sure what you're talking about there.
I don't know either.
It's recommendations time, McLean.
Is this like do you remember in the 80s when children's television started up on ITV? They had kids, you won't remember this, obviously, but Matthew Kelly was the first face, as I recall, for children's ITV. And he started off and he had like a spaceship set where the camera was looking front at him and he was in the pilot seat and he'd have a few levers he would pull. And that noise makes me think of one of those levers.
Ever build your own spaceship when you were a kid? Like a sort of like area that you could sit in with like, and you'd draw controls on bits of paper?
I remember my grandmother, who lived in Wales at the time, went over to see her and they'd built a small little TARDIS police box with a TARDIS inside for me. I can't remember how old I was, 28, 29, as the old joke goes. I don't know, probably about 6 or 7. And it was really, you know, it was a really nice thing because, again, there wasn't much merchandise out there. And you certainly couldn't buy yourself a police box for 3 grand as you can now.
No.
But, of course, as a kid, I was very upset because the console was just like a cardboard box with lots of buttons that had been stuck onto the top. And quite a nice variation of buttons, but it was a cardboard box. There was no hexagonality to it. How could I be happy with that as a kid? You know, kids just aren't. Kids aren't easily pleased.
Well, no, kids notice these things, don't they?
And they do.
They do kind of demand some precision.
Do you? Were you a kid who preferred? You got vehicles and you got figures. Did you like to have the more accurate figures, or would you prefer to have the more accurate scaled vehicles? Because obviously things like Star Trek, for the size of the figures, the Falcon would be like four times the size.
Yeah, I had a lot of issues with scale, which Star Wars you could kind of get away with, more or less, although the scale wasn't perfect. It was close.
But, it was close on some of them, and then obviously in others it was just...
But with, you know, when Transformers came along, that kind of turned it around, because all of a sudden... you had these robots which, in vehicle mode, they were more or less in scale. Then when they transformed, they weren't in scale to what you knew from the cartoon. So, and then you had this other aspect to it where you had their relationship with people. And then you had the original toys' relationships with the original people that sat in them in the Japanese versions.
Well, the Japanese versions, because strangely enough, for the last 15,000 words, I was studying a little bit of this.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese version was simple. They didn't I think we might have said this before, they didn't have names. So they were just, and they were transposed. It was the Americans who created the names and the backstories.
Well, there's a similarity between the Transformers comic, isn't there? Transformers cartoon and the Battle of the Planets cartoon, isn't there? Whereas the robots, what was the robot? Zero Quark.
Seven Zark Seven.
That was an American animation, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was slotted in to assist with the narrative. And they did the same with Transformers with the Teletron 1 scenes.
Well, the Transformers was done for America. It wasn't done for Japan.
I understood the first series was Japanese, and they slotted in the Teletron scenes to assist with the narrative.
I'd have to look up. What I read, the idea was is that the Japanese, that the Americans appropriated and patented two toy lines from one Japanese company.
Mm-hmm,
one that did air vehicles was one toy line from the company, and the other company toy line, which is under a different brand, was one which did things like cassette recorders and guns, which is why you suddenly got this massive odd mix of scales and Transformers,
because
it was two different toy lines. The Americans applied together. So again, I could be wrong. There could be some more subtleties to it that you're talking about that I've not missed. But again, it's, as you say, it all becomes fascinating stuff, especially as kids, because it becomes frustrating as kids, because you've got these issues of not just scales within the toys, but then you see these cartoons and you see even more different scales and refined objects as well. I mean, you can't say that Bumblebee as a toy for the 80s was anything like Bumblebee on the television or Ironhide.
Ironhide and Ratchet Ironside in particular were completely different.
Absolutely. So that would frustrate you as a kid.
It frustrated the hell out of me. I even once considered building a cardboard Ratchet.
Exactly. And it got even more annoying when you get into your adults and suddenly you see them produce these new versions of the toys, which are sort of, there's one version of Optimus Prime, which was about 80 quid or something, which was identical to the cartoon one, and it transformed.
They've done a Ratchet as well. And they've probably done
why
an Ironhide.
Why did I get those?
Yeah.
Why did I have to have the flimsy plastic screen face Ironhide? I wanted the thing that was on the TV.
Oh
nostalgia. It's funny, isn't it, how these sort of emotions are mapped across all the people of the same generations. dissatisfaction. I wanted a lightsaber in my Luke Skywalker, which wasn't inserted in his higher arm, that slid up his arm and came out the end with an odd little plasticky endy thready bit. You know, it's, I remember from the 90s onwards, I got so jealous with toys.
But I actually did want that Luke Skywalker, because I had the opposite Darth Vader and the Obi-Wan Kenobi, so I wanted the Luke Skywalker that did that, but I didn't have the Luke Skywalker that did that. I had the Hoth Skywalker and the Jedi Skywalker. And the Speederbike Skywalker as well, and the X-Wing Skywalker, but I didn't have sort of Tatooine wearing half a karate outfit Skywalker.
The one I liked was the Bespin Skywalker, because he had the lightsaber prop welded onto his body form, and it was actually a fairly accurate one, even though it was black. You can see all this on the internet if you're all interested in seeing it, if you don't know about old Star Wars toys. Again, it's fascinating because it's different eras, different expectations. And, you know, they were top of the range.
Yeah. Shall we move on to recommendations then, since our hats have introduced this section on toys?
All right, okay. Was that what the music was for?
Yeah, well, shall I go first?
Go on.
Yeah, okay, because I've got quite a small recommendation this week, and it's completely, it's like a revolutionary recommendation. We've never recommended this at all. Okay, I recommend, right, if you're bored with music, if you want to listen to music that you should have already heard, but somehow you didn't hear it, okay, it passed you by or whatever, listen to Six Music, BBC Six Music. If you can't listen to it because you're abroad, you can because it's a digital station. You can listen to it on the internet. You can listen to it on your TV in the UK, and you can listen to it on the DAB band. I've discovered this song by The Undertones called Wednesday Week. Now, the song's like 35 years old. I haven't heard it before until the last fortnight. I didn't realise who it was by, so I looked it up. I thought it was a brand new song. It sounds so utterly fresh. So I'm not recommending The Undertones. The Undertones, you know, if you know who The Undertones are, you know, Teenage Kicks and all that, you should already know that they're a reasonably good Irish band from the new wave punk era. But you know, if you want to hear music that you should have heard already, but for some reason haven't, then listen to Six Music from the BBC. And you could take that as a bit of a BBC endorsement as well. But if you're not listening to Six Music already, then you should be, basically. So that's my recommendation.
I absolutely agree. Oh, it's a good recommendation. As long as it's not a snotty recommendation where you're suggesting a certain type of music is what should be appropriate.
Well, no, because they do go through, you know, a lot of different types of music during the day. And they have classic albums and artists of the day or week or whatever. But, you are going to hear music that you maybe haven't heard for like 40 years or so. Or, as I say, something that you should have heard, something that you should be aware of, but for some reason are not. Which is where my recommendation comes from.
No, I think that's good. That's a good recommendation. It's interesting, rather unusual.
Well, it did warn you.
It is a sort of recommendation, but recommended it many times before. I managed to get onto Chapter 4 of Legacy, the video game.
All right.
Online video game from the Doctor Who Legacy. And which pleased me, because I was for weeks stuck on one of the last penultimate ones on the third chapter, and I just couldn't get past it. And in the end, I had to sort of gather up about 12 crystals, and I used 5 of them. it took me ages. I was just sitting on that level. I'd actually gone back and started a new set of characters and was building them up. I'm on to the Chapter 4, which is very good. It's very enjoyable. And again, it's not really to say anything we haven't said before, but I still think if you're listening to this podcast, you really should be supporting some of these ventures. I mean, Legacy does have advertising if you don't want to spend the £3.30 or whatever it is ongoing premium. Don't quote me on that price. I don't think it's much, but you can still support it. I hope through the ad revenue generated from that helps them keep going. It's a good one, and the same with Big Finish. Obviously, if you've still not checked out any Big Finish, Casterbus often tells you when they've got good deals going on, so keep an eye out for that and pick, you know, the CD up for £5. It stuns me actually when I think how many people don't listen to Big Finish. And yet it's just, not just is it filled with Doctor Who, but it's run by people who are absolutely obsessed by it. So, you know, Nick Briggs as an obvious example of one such person. So why the hell any adult who is earning some money can't occasionally try Big Finish? I'm surprised, you know, because I'm sure a lot of them do, but you think of how many Doctor Who fans are around the country. I bet not even a quarter of them have bought a Big Finish CD. And you think, you know, what other show do you get the opportunity to listen to Tom Baker reprise his role from 30 years ago? Or, you know, as we've said before, William Russell as Ian Chesterton. Or as we're getting now, you know, John Barrowman starting again in Torchwood. It's an incredible thing. And I do really think that not enough fans embrace it, because I don't think there's virtually any other show which has that sort of attention to detail as Doctor Who has. Am I wrong? Does Star Trek have as many audio CDs with original cast members coming out every month? Can you think of any genre which does what Big Finish does? I can't.
The Uhura Chronicles.
Well, that's it, exactly. I mean, I know Star Trek obviously does do a lot of stuff for its fans, and the fans, you know, it's got a very vibrant community. I'm not knocking anyone, but I don't think there's any show I can think of which has that sort of commitment that something like Big Finish gives Doctor Who. Incredible amount of commitment. It's a wonderful thing, and, you know, especially for people like Paul McGann, and having just reviewed, as we say, for Casterbris, We Are the Daleks, which has Bonnie Langford back, which is great because she was obviously, I could be quite blunt and say, largely despised for her time on Doctor Who at the time by fandom. And she's able to be there, like Colin Baker got the opportunity as well. And Matthew Waterhouse might have had the opportunity recently as well, you know, to actually reprise these roles and show what they can do with a, you know, more experience, retrospective understanding of the role without the pressures of the time affecting them, a little more breathing space. A production which has more space to be sympathetic to them as characters and actors. It's a wonderful retrospective. I mean, this whole podcast about retrospectiveness. It's brilliant. It's wonderful. You know, so if you've not listened to any of the Big Finish stuff, you know, bloody well, go out and get some. It's got to be something out there that you could see and you'd like. I mean, for fans, I mean, you know, what other show could have something like Jago and Lightfoot meeting Strax? I mean, as absurd as it is, if you want that sort of minutiae of continuity connection over 50 years, it's there. So, yeah, the only other thing I'll recommend, obviously, as I said, The Thick of It, I've never watched it before. I obviously saw the clips when Capaldi was announced.
Yeah. Have you seen
watched it. So yes, it's been fascinating to watch.
And have you watched the film yet?
No.
No. Okay.
I'm a couple of episodes through into series 3 at the moment.
Okay.
And yeah, it's not quite what I, in some ways I think it's brilliant. I think he's obviously very good. I think the acting's very good. The fly on the wall works. I mean, it does feel, you know, like, I think, in some ways, I liked a little more of a sort of an Americanization to it, where some of the comedy was pulled back in the absurdity of the realism of the characters. And there was a little more structure to the whole politics, almost. I almost feel like it crying for a little more depth than it gives you. But then the whole point of it is to show how shallow the system is, I suppose.
So
occasionally I kind of feel I want something a little deeper from it. But it's a brilliant show, and it's just, it's so wonderful. The other thing I watched this week was November Man with Pierce Brosnan.
Pierce Brosnan. Oh, right. I spotted that on Netflix the other day. I thought, this looks really good.
Exactly, and that's what I did. I spotted it on Netflix the other day and thought, this looks really good. I'd had a weird situation where I'd actually enjoyed Mission Impossible 4, which I had just watched on Netflix on a whim, and actually enjoyed it, even though I'm not... I think Simon Pegg's a great person. I think he's a fantastic fan. I've never been, you know, a massive fan of him in the sense that he does end up having to play very similar sort of characters.
Yeah.
But he works in it. He foils off Cruise very well. And Cruise is not someone who does much for me personally. And he seems to be on virtually everything on Netflix somehow. But it just works. It's a good story. It flows. And from there, I thought, yeah, I want to see some more of these sort of action thrillers. And November Man is a very good one. So if you've not watched that, November Man's worth a look at as well.
Okay, right. Now we didn't do a podcast last week, although we did, but we didn't. So, but if you're I can skip this because by the time the podcast goes out, I'll have done it already. So, forget that. Edit this bit out.
Rings of Akaten. Watch it because you'll upset at least one person on the Disturbers team by watching it, and enjoy it. Make sure you enjoy it, because that will upset him even further.
So that brings us to the end of this week's Casterbris podcast with a K. Thank you to James, and thank you to you, dear listener. And we will be back in some sort of configuration of noise versus silence next time. Eventually, there it is again.